Welcome to the Regenerative Medicine Podcast Series, brought to you by the Association of Academic Physiatrists. This podcast was created through the joint efforts of the Technology and Research Subcommittees of the Resident and Fellows Council of the AAP. Join us as we interview researchers and leaders in the field of regenerative medicine. This podcast is intended for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine. This series is not intended to be a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The views and opinions expressed by guests and hosts on this podcast are their own and do not represent any organization or institution. Hi, welcome to our podcast series. Today, our co-hosts are Vaibhav Patheja, a third-year resident at NYU Langone Hospital, Shannon Stratter, a second-year resident at the University of Louisville, and I am Josh Lewis, a first-year resident currently doing my prelim year at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital. Today's guest is Dr. Michael Boninger. Dr. Boninger is a professor in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He has joint appointments in the Department of Bioengineering, Rehabilitation Science and Technology, and the Clinical and Translational Science Institute, as well as the McGowan Institute of Regenerative Medicine. He is also a physician researcher in the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. He is president of the UPMC Innovative Home Care Solutions, which is a nonprofit company designed to implement innovative post-acute and community-based programs that provide high-value care while improving the patient experience. In regards to his personal background, Dr. Boninger earned a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering and his medical degree at The Ohio State University. He completed his residency in physical medicine and rehabilitation in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, where he became the chief resident. He has an extensive publication record with over 270 peer-reviewed papers and has received substantial funding from numerous agencies, including the Department of Veterans Affairs, the NIH, the Department of Defense, and the National Institute of Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. His central focus is on enabling increased function and participation for individuals with disabilities through the development and application of assistive, rehabilitative, and regenerative technologies. I guess I'll start off. So first off, wanted to just say thanks for doing this. This is amazing. We're really glad that we were able to have Jen and kind of help set this up. And you're actually going to be our first guest. So this is, you know, the inaugural event, I guess. but to start off, maybe we can just go into a little bit about your background. Like, how did you get to where you're currently at and what brought you into, you know, rehab medicine?
That sounds like a long, boring podcast that people will likely turn off immediately. So don't do it. I promise to make it quick. Listen, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I was working in a restaurant, saw a person have a heart attack while I was working, and I had no idea what to do. There were a bunch of podiatrists, interestingly enough, but they had more training than me. And at that point, it kind of seemed like medicine was the field to go into. I was really afraid that I wasn't going to get into med school because I had just above a C average in high school, which is a great comfort to parents. I tell this story too. And so I majored in mechanical engineering. I liked engineering and took that mechanical engineering background into med school. I had really no exposure to rehab until my third year in medical school and was exposed to it, loved the long-term relationship with patients, loved the engineering aspects of it. And it seemed like an obvious choice for me. I then did my residency at the University of Michigan and hated it, not because I hate the University of Michigan, although I went to Ohio State, so that's almost expected, but because it just was one patient after another. And for me, that was not what I wanted to do. And there was an attending there at the time named Dan Barry, who was very influential in my career. If you can get him on this podcast, you should. And Dan said, "Hey, Mike, don't quit," which was why I talked to him about doing that. He said, "Do research instead." From there, really started doing research during residency. First job, told him I wanted to do primary research. And then really that's been most of my career has been either research or administration. If you're good at research, it does open up doors for you to become a department chair, which I've done, a dean, which I've done, a president of a company, which I'm doing right now, and leadership in many labs. And so it's been a great ride for me.
Yeah. Can I ask just a follow-up question? This is obviously a little bit off the script, but it seems like you're wearing a ton of hats. And I'm just curious as to, maybe we can talk about this a little bit later, but I'm curious as to like your strategies as to how to juggle all those responsibilities. Like how does that...
The strategy to juggling responsibilities is delegation and mentorship. I used to tell people as a department chair that if I was doing my job well, I could sleep at my desk all day long because they would be seeing the patients, they would be running things. And mentorship is probably the thing I enjoy the most in my career. And mentorship is really what drives me. And it's through mentorship that I've been able to have people help me, work with me, and be part of a team that enables really wonderful accomplishments. That's really been the secret.
Yeah.
How do you think about your background with engineering? How has that played an influence, and how do you think it contributes to your thought process as a physician now? That's a very unique background as a mechanical engineer.
I'll tell you a story, which is that my first year in medical school, I flunked every test I had because in engineering school, the tests are all open book. And I called into the dean's office and he said, another story that helps parents feel better about their kids. I got called into the dean's office and he said, you know, I'm not sure medicine is for you, that this is your, you know, your performance would seem to indicate that you're not going to make it. And, you know, so the engineering degree, right, then I realized that what I had to do was memorize things and then forget it the next day. And I got pretty decent at that and was able to graduate med school. But it, an engineering degree really does change how you think about things. I think engineers are natural problem solvers. If you give a lecture in front of a group of engineers, they will raise their hands with solutions. They might not be good solutions, but they'll be solutions. I think that everything that I do is kind of impacted by that. There are stories that I tell over and over again on how an engineering approach to a problem can inform how you solve a problem.
You mentioned this a little bit. I'm curious. So you talked about mentorship, and I know when we reached out to you, that was one of the things that you highlighted. And you specifically said, I'm just going to quote this, one of the highlights of your journey has been mentoring brilliant junior researchers. So maybe we can dive in a little bit more on that. Like, how does that look for you? And how, you know, how did you become involved with mentoring? Obviously, as a teacher, I feel like that's kind of comes with the job, but some individuals do a really good job and some don't.
Well, okay, the good job, bad job thing, I'll leave alone. I can obviously, we can talk about it more, but you'll have to ask a more pointed question. The way I became involved is, again, if you take a research career as opposed to a pure clinical career, and an academic career offers this to you. So this is the AAP. It's about academics. And I think one of the best thing, if not the best thing about an academic career is the opportunity to mentor. In research, often you get to mentor PhD students. And what that mentorship looks like for the MDs who don't have a PhD in the audience is 4 to 5 year, 6 year relationship with the student who comes to you as an undergrad and leaves with a doctorate. And the students that I've worked with, the best students I've worked with, when they were done with their doctoral degree, did not hate me, which I consider a major accomplishment. And in fact, three of several great doctoral students decided to stay on. And one of them, Fabrizia Ambrosio, and she came with a PT degree. And we did research in MS, and I said, let's have you do a postdoc in something completely different. And she is the person who is really the lead PI on the regenerative rehabilitation grant. That is one of the reasons I think I was asked to do this podcast. And to this day, she calls me for advice. She, for several years, was the number one funded investigator. And she actually knocked me off of that pedestal, I might say, as the number one funded investigator in the country. And I can tell you stories about that related to Jen Collinger, who is my doctoral student and is now one of the president of the Brain Computer Interface Society of America, I think it is, or maybe I think it might be more than just American Society, and is vying with Dr. Ambrosio for number one funding. And then Lynn Warabe, who's doing brilliant research in wheelchairs and how to prescribe them better and how to work with them better, and got a perfect score on her first NIHK award. And so if you mentoring people leads to this type of productivity, and I'm just lucky to have been able to work with the three people I'm telling you about and several others.
Yeah. Did you feel like when they came to you, what were some of the qualities that you kind of identified? Or are you able to kind of identify qualities in an individual when they come to you and want to have this mentorship relationship?
I would love to tell you that my choosing of doctoral students is always that great. One thing is that it's always been doctoral students who wanted to work with me. One of the things that actually set me apart from other doctoral advisors was that I was a physician and I had the opportunity to involve them in direct patient interaction, and they all love direct patient interaction. They were all nice people, just first high quality people that you'd love to, you know, have a drink or dinner with, and decent people. And then they're just all three smarter than I am. And so that, you know, the secret is you kind of coax them along until they realize they're smarter than you. And then you say, okay, now do you want a job? And so that worked out really well. I don't know that there's another thing I could, you know, specifically put my finger on, but it's that kind of combination of great people with great intellect who care about patients that really maybe set these three and other students I've had apart.
Yeah, it's incredible learning about your diverse background. In terms of regenerative medicine, what kind of brought you to getting involved with this field?
It was really Dr. Ambrosio Fabrizia, who goes by Fabi. Like I said, we talked a lot about her during her dissertation about what she wanted to do next. And at that time, there was really, I had said, hey, you know, I think that the cellular end of rehab is an understudied field. And here's an opportunity to work with a mentor who does research in this area. She then, and she is one of the most brilliant out-of-the-box thinkers that I think I've ever met, went on and said, you know, that what's understudied is the physical interaction between cells. Mechanobiology is what I like to think of it as explained, although it's more than mechanics because it's often electricity, other things. What we do as physiatrists every day interacts at a cellular level. Well, if you understand that, then how can you ignore that cellular interaction when you're applying a cellular therapy? And so Fabrizia took that, ran with it. I think in many ways is the, it's usually father of the field, mother of the field. I need a gender neutral way of describing that, but she is really the founder of this regenerative rehabilitation field. And I keep on, you know, I've always expected her, and there are funny stories here where I'd say, you know, you're done with me. I have nothing left to teach you. You don't need me to be on your next grant. And she'll drag me, you know, kicking and screaming back in. A role that sometimes I get to play as a senior investigator is that NIH panels and other peer review panels like to see that there's somebody on the grant who's had grant experience before, who has mentored before, has taught before. And in the last submission, you know, once again, there's another individual who's in this named Tom Rando, who just recently moved to UCLA. And Tom and Fabi called me up and said, you got to do this again. So what I would say is that she's just kind of brought me along for this amazing ride that she has crafted and spread to the nation on some level over time.
So it sounds like the circle is complete. Good mentorship was also provided to you, as well as you, you know, giving back to the community now. In terms of some of our listeners who might not have so much exposure to orthobiologics or PRP, can you tell us what orthobiologics and PRP encompass, and what does that term mean to you?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I think that orthobiologics to me mean, I'm going to give you what they mean, and then I'm going to give you an association, right? Orthobiologics to me mean the, you know, the application of biological substances in an orthopedic realm, right? So I'm just actually kind of reading back the definition of the word. I hear orthobiologics used more clinically than I do from a research perspective. What I hear when I'm talked to about the work that we do and that I've done in regenerative medicine is, hey, let's talk about PRP. And that almost inevitably stops me in my tracks, because the concern I always have in what this has defined orthobiologics to some extent is people saying, hey, this is a really good idea. Let's start doing it in patients and then see if it works. And so, you know, I think there is tremendous potential in PRP and in other therapies. And some of them have great evidence behind them and others do not. And, you know, so and, you know, just on a personal note, I did have my first PRP injection because running has become more challenging for me, you know, and I got it with hyaluronic acid at the same time. So I don't know which one of them worked, but I certainly did feel better for a period of time. I think that orthobiologics are one end of it, and that in the context of rehab, that we should always think about what's the second step, right? So actually, first step should be let's have really good studies to show that it works. Then the next step should be, and in those studies, let's make sure that if we're going to inject a rabbit model with these orthobiologics, that we're actually tracking what the rabbit does afterwards, right? Mm-hmm. Many of the early studies in regenerative medicine would say, hey, let's put the stem cell someplace. And then they just let the, you know, mouse run around the cage and not say, hey, if, you know, what exercise routine would we use? And so we should do these studies. We should, when we're doing these studies, we should know the basic science behind it. And then we should have good clinical studies that also incorporate rehab to show that it works or whether it works or not. Maybe not the answer you expected, but it was the answer you're going to get.
No, that's great. Kind of following up to that, I'm curious as to, you mentioned that there are some that are you're excited about, some that sound like they're a little bit overhyped, maybe. Can you go into that? Which are some of the therapies on the horizon that you see that actually have some promise, and some, which are the ones that are maybe goose eggs, I guess?
So I think they all have promise. Well, and there's not one that I think is a goose egg necessarily. I just don't think that they have been necessarily regulated well. So there are people who are injecting stem cells anywhere they can think of and charging out-of-pocket expenses for that. And that is something that I don't think we as physiatrists want to be a part of. We want to make sure that we're doing something that we have really, either it's part of a study where we're learning if it works, or we know it works, and then we're the people that are providing it and doing it in a great fashion. And, you know, I think that there are a ton of stem cell therapies, but, you know, what happens to the stem cell when you inject it? And there are things like PRP, which is not a, you know, not a stem cell, but may have an impact on the regenerative capacity that already exists, right? But if you want to impact regenerative, you know, capacity that already exists, one of the things that we know, you know, in part from Fabi's work, on which she has included me on a publication or two, is that muscles have their own regenerative stem cell capacity, and that exercise is the thing that actually revs up me as an old person compared to the young people who are interviewing me. My stem cells are revved up if I exercise. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really not meant to be a dodge. I think that as we learn more and more about the mechanobiology of stem cells, about how they differentiate and what are the clues to differentiation, then we will be better as physicians and clinicians. And if I got excited about one thing recently, it probably is not necessarily stem cells, but the vesicles that they actually transmit may have an impact at a muscle or other level, causing a regenerative response. And so I think there's a lot of great work to be done, and there's a lot of great work out there.
Yeah.
So it definitely seems like there's a lot of excitement in this field, as well as possibly a lot of misinformation as well, and some overcreated hype. What is the general thought process about in terms of the believed mechanisms of action surrounding the platelet-rich plasma and the orthobiologics, and how do you interpret it yourself?
I think that the mechanism of action, you know, will vary. Mechanism of action of orthobiologics is a really broad area, right? I think if you talk to people who use platelet-rich plasma, they will talk to you about an inflammatory response that it might create. They'll talk to you about proteins that stimulate stem cell or healing. And I'm not even positive that I'm the expert in this. I'm completely positive that I am not the expert in this area. So if you're hoping for a treatise on what is, you know, how PRP works or how an individual stem cell works, you know, you got the wrong guy. What I can tell you is about mentorship, and I think we've talked about that a little bit. And I can tell you about the scientific process, and I can tell you that orthobiologics have, as I would venture to say that the mechanism of action will always be multifaceted, and that it'll be a combination of direct cellular action for a cellular implant, but it'll also be about what the cells transmit, how they're incorporated into the milieu, the structural foundation they're built on. There are so many aspects to regenerative medicine. And if you really listen, there's no one who wants you to get better at fixing articular cartilage in a knee than me. And that will take a, you know, a multifaceted approach. I believe that in the future, there will be a regenerative component to that for sure.
Yeah. Can I go back to something you said a couple of minutes ago? You mentioned that there are definitely people in the field who may be inappropriately doing some of these treatments and treating some of these patients with faulty science and kind of almost selling them on something that may not have good evidence for. I'm just curious, have you had any experience with patients in discussing some of these hard topics? Or if a patient comes in saying like, hey, you know, I'd love to get this treatment XYZ, like how do you sit down? And the reason why I'm asking this is I've had a patient, for example, who traveled to out of the country to receive, you know, a stem cell injection in a way that was not necessarily well regulated and came back with like an epidural abscess from the procedure. And so, you know, I and obviously there's, you know, sterile technique that's involved in all that whole aspect, but I've found that it's sometimes difficult to have conversations with some of these patients because they are looking for some sort of procedure to, you know, the fountain of youth. They're looking for something to kind of bring them back to their previous status, I guess.
So I have had conversations like that several times in the past. They have not generally been surrounding musculoskeletal issues. The area that I work most closely in is spinal cord injury. And in the spinal cord injury realm, there are, you know, hundreds of patients who have flown to other countries to have stem cells injected into their spine and had no results, less than optimal results. And at times, I know there's at least a few people that have passed away after those types of procedures. And when talking to a patient like that, what you do is what you always do as a physician, I think, which is present hope, but also present reality and talk about the fact that there's a reason why they're not approved in the US. There's a reason why we're not doing it here, that there are complications that can occur that will not stop some people from it. They want their life back. And I've certainly seen the desperation in the eyes of patients. And listen, if someone said, how much would you pay to be able to run again? It'd be a lot. I miss running a lot. And the, you know, it, would I fly to China to be able to run again? Well, you know, if I read the study and I read the evidence, and so it really comes down to trusting your physician and the relationship you build with your patient. You know, the COVID vaccine information that I've read has said that the single person who's most likely to change the mind of someone who doesn't want the vaccination is their primary care physician. So a long-term relationship with someone who's got a complaint that they think might be amenable to stem cell or another treatment that is unproven is a way to say, you know, you've trusted me. It's not that I don't do it here. It's not that I can't do it here. It's that I won't do it here because the evidence doesn't support it and I'm worried about the safety. That kind of heart-to-heart talk has worked for me and it has not. There are patients who have left after I've had that talk and had it done and then, you know, come back. And, you know, fortunately, the one or two cases I can think of that have not had a bad outcome, but they all have come back and said, you know, after a few years, the placebo effect is an amazing thing. Yeah. And it, you know, it confounds research. It's a really remarkable thing. And they'll come back and they'll say, it's the best thing I ever did. And then a few years later in the spinal cord injury realm, and I wouldn't imagine that's very different in musculoskeletal medicine either, say, hey, I appreciate the advice you gave me and I'll listen to you in the future.
Yeah.
So what do you think is contributing to this? Is it the fact that maybe some component of the media is overhyping this as well? You always hear about all these athletes who are getting this miracle cure, or is there some overexcitement clouding this reality? It's also could be based off of PRP is, you know, relatively non-invasive and it's almost considered like a magical treatment. You don't need to undergo surgery. You don't need to do prolonged physical therapy. So it's Is it the fact that it's almost proposed as a quick fix that it's exciting in generating all of this in the media? What do you think of that?
I should start by saying that I think there is some strong evidence for PRP. I don't want to go into that specifically, but PRP has got a little bit more research behind it than some of the other ones we're talking about. Not sure it did when we started using it, but it has developed some research backing. So I can imagine all of the physiatrists out there sending angry letters to me saying, Mike doesn't read the literature. He doesn't know the PRP literature. Although, you know, I've been parts of discussions on other areas where the data related to injections in the spine and other thing, very exciting debates where some really spectacular researchers, I think, showed very well. Why is it, again, I think I use the term multifactorial too often, but there are several reasons. One is clearly the media. In the brain-computer interface research that I do, gotten a lot of media attention, been on major news networks. They interview me. I talk to them about how there's hope that this would in someday cure paralysis in some way. I couch it in 15 different terms. I talk about how long it's going to take. And the headline of the story is something about doctors curing paralysis and the thought that that's something that could happen tomorrow. So media hype is part of it. I also think that there is a hype on my part. Now, this is not necessarily true in the PRP realm, but it'd be wrong not to talk about it. There is also hype that researchers generate, because if you write a grant and you say, we're going to cure paralysis in 40 years, there is a chance that the review panel is going to say, you know, I don't want to wait, you know, I don't want to wait 40 years, or someone who might donate to that is not going to want to wait 40 years. So the researchers themselves are in a bind where they're trying to decide between, you know, am I going to hype this or not? I think that, you know, so researchers and then clinicians, we all have our anecdotal cases, our ends of one that make us feel comfortable, and we want to offer something to our patients. And that's another component of it. And then, you know, you talked about the non-invasive. I had a funny conversation with the hospital administrator that will go unnamed at some point. And we were talking about low back pain and exercise. And actually the molecular response is Gwen Soa, the chair of the department in Pittsburgh, who's also brilliant, did a lot of work talking about the anti-inflammatory effects of stretching and how that can impact the spine. And we were talking about this, and it was in front of a surgeon, and this was in a role as a hospital administrator in my administrative roles. And the surgeon said, well, you know, if you get really good, you're going to put us out of business because we make so much money off of these spine surgeries. And the hospital administrator said, oh, you don't have to worry about that. People will always choose being cut rather than exercising. And I do think that, you know, I'm a huge proponent of exercise as the best medicine. And I do think there's a group of people that are like, are you kidding me? Work out three times a week for an hour, or have you stick a needle in my joint? Much rather have a needle stuck in my joint. And so there is safety. There's, you know, there's many different things that go into this. And I think that, you know, what a good physician needs to do is to talk about that. So there is a TEDx talk I gave, which is actually talk, you know, the title is The Hype and Hope of Assistive Technology. And it dives into this in kind of a major way. What's our role as doctors, I think, is the most important part of that. And I think our role as doctors is to understand everything that drives patients, drives ourselves, and then just give great advice and recommendation to our patients.
Yeah. I really like that.
I know you had mentioned that there are some positive things that have come out in literature and studies. I've seen some myself in regards to like lateral epicondylitis, as well as mild to moderate knee OA, and considerations for a lot of musculoskeletal conditions. Is there anything else that you've seen out in literature?
Related specifically to PRP or related to any aspect?
I would say related to PRP.
Yeah, I'm gonna take the fifth on that one again. I'm not an expert in PRP, and I will constantly push back, you know, in terms of let's not let regenerative rehabilitation be defined by PRP.
Yeah.
There is so much that we can do. We should be learning the biology of recovery of muscle, nerve, tendon, everything. And so we put a regenerative rehabilitation course on every year. or at least we did pre-COVID, and now it's been virtual and it'll come back next year. It'll be in Texas. Great course, come to the course. But every single year, there's a couple physiatrists there and other physicians. I'll pick on the physiatrists because they come up to me and they introduce themselves. And they're like, you know, where's the PRP information? And I'm like, this is a regenerative rehabilitation course. This is not just about PRP. And you know, one other thing I'll tell you, as you guys are aware, maybe myself and John White run a program called the Rehab Medicine Scientist Training Program, and it trains the next generation of NIH-funded researchers. And we get applicants to that program who, like, they are coming into the program to prove that PRP works. And I got to tell you, you know, number one, that's kind of a bad supposition. And number two, the, you know, NIH panels are so done with that, right? Talk about molecular mechanisms. Don't propose another randomized trial that says that it didn't work the last time because they didn't use fluoro, or it didn't work the last time because it was spun the wrong way or the wrong dosage or something else. You know, I'm going to always push back. Regenerative rehabilitation is something that residents should learn about. They should learn about it outside of the context of a single procedure. And then, you know, good resident grand rounds is diving into PRP. I think that's given about every 6 months at every single residency program in the country. And you know, the fact that as more evidence comes out and as we show that it's working, the fact that that's in our tool belt is great. But do you see as many lectures on how exercise can be a really effective treatment for knee OA? And do we talk about how, what is the exercise regimen, and is it isometric or isokinetic? And do, you know, what's the range of motion? How do you deal with someone? And even those exercises might have a regenerative capacity that we should be talking about. So yeah, I you know, I don't know if I didn't warn you guys off enough when you asked to interview me, but I knew it was going to go this way. And so you can cut it all out if you want.
No. I think this is really beneficial, because I think this is part of the reason why we wanted to have you on there. There are a lot of people that when they hear regenerative medicine, they instantly kind of associate that with PRP. And I think that this gives our listeners a good opportunity to kind of realize there's more to it. I want to go, you talked a little bit about this course. I know doing a little bit of background research for this, I saw that you had recently published a paper where you suggested even doing a regenerative rehabilitation curriculum. And I'm curious as to how that would look. Like, maybe you can just talk a little bit about that.
Sure. That came out of one of the conferences. I think there were probably 30 authors on that paper or something like that. And part of what we've been saying is that if you really want to do regenerative rehabilitation as a field, then what you have to do is include both basic scientists who understand stem cell biology and understand the mechanisms that are behind it. You need to include clinicians who understand what a realistic rehabilitation exercise regimen might be. And it's the cross of that that we would love to see in a number of different areas. We believe it's, you know, a really critical place in bioengineering. Get more bioengineers understanding exercise, understanding mechanobiology, understanding substrates. And it's going in that direction because it has exploded. In a PM&R curriculum, what would I want to see? I think for us to have a little bit better ability to explain the basic science behind rehabilitation helps us. It helps us when we're talking to our cardiology and neurology colleagues. It helps us when we're talking to our patients and when we're evaluating literature that is out there. So it would look like I think it would be a cool lecture series to have the basic biology of rehab. Mm-hmm. And one lecture in that would be the stem cells that are associated with that and the ability to intervene in a stem cell type capacity. And I think I'd want to see that in PT school and in OT school too. But certainly as a physician run subspecialty, I think we would be just a great group to like jump to the top of that. And the fact that Fabrizia is in a PM&R department, and that there's sponsorship and that this multi-site grant, you know, we have four sites, and Carmen Terzic, who does stem cells for cardiac disease, is in there too, is all, you know, makes me excited about PM&R and where we're going to go.
Yeah.
I had a question. Your pathway in residency, you said you were immediately interested in research and not so much the day-to-day life of patient care. How did you manage that and like get support with that pathway? Because it's very hard from my perspective, because we have so much clinical duties, clinical hours, expectations. And my past 2 years, I haven't taken any vacation. I've just done research. And so it's very hard to find time to do. So what advice, I guess, would you give to those who are actually genuinely interested in research and regen rehab and basic science?
Well, join the RMSTP is the first, you know, piece of advice for anybody who's genuinely interested in research. So for the audience, look it up, RMSTP, AAP, it'll come up, and, you know, talk to your program director about it. I think that if you're a medical student and you're trying to decide where to go to residency, there are residency programs like the University of Pittsburgh, and I can name a couple that have a resident research track where you would have more time to do research, and that can help you. If you were at a residency program and you're doing your best, and the only time that you can do research is on your vacation, which, you know, Shannon, you got to get a vacation. We can talk after the show, but I want to email from you. Tell me where you're going on your vacation next, because it's really important that you do that. I think if you're in your residency program and you just can't get a break, and you can't get away, then, you know, I don't know that I have. Listen, when I did research, first of all, I'll tell you that in the days of the dinosaurs, when I did residency, I think the patients weren't quite as sick, and the workload wasn't quite as high. And we were whining about that they could only stay on rehab for 6 weeks, which I think is, you know, like kind of unheard of now for a stroke patient. And so I'm not one of those people who walked uphill to work both ways when I was doing my residency. So I think the stressors might be harder now. You know, then I would say that if you really want to do research, like I said, sign up for the RMSTP, and then you can go to a place post-graduation or a fellowship post-graduation where you can get into the research aspects, have more time to do it. And that might be the best way. I mean, for me, it really was something I did, you know, I didn't realize it right away. I realized that patient care wasn't for me because I worked as an engineer for a couple of years. And then I talked to someone who said, here's an alternative pathway. And that was great. The last thing I would say, and it's great because it comes first full circle on our conversation, is that find a mentor. Find somebody at your institution if they don't exist in your department. And frankly, what I think you should do, Shannon, is email me when this is over and we can talk more. But find an institute, someone in your department, because that's what I did, right? I found this one guy who went to the EMG lab once a week and disappeared. And I'm like, what do you do the rest of the week? And you're always so happy. And he said, I do research. And I'm like, really? I learn a little bit more about that. So see if there's someone there. And if they're not in your department, find them in another department, see what a physician researcher like life looks like. And that'll help you get down the path. And there are many people like myself on a national level that see the importance of this, that are willing to mentor people, even if they're not at their own institution.
Thank you. One follow-up and then I'll be done. You mentioned about the rehab curriculum, and I actually did a journal club on that journal or publication. So I read it quite in depth. And I really believe in curriculum as the number one start or the beginning to change the field, I guess, shape the young minds of residents. But do you foresee a fellowship, like a particular regen rehab fellowship, where there are like more of a basic science for clinicians and possibly if basic scientists want to do it, more of a clinical aspect to it?
Listen, I think a fellowship in 15 years in regenerative rehabilitation would be really cool, where you learned, you know, what are the regenerative approaches that you can take? What's the rehab regimen associated with them? How do you deliver the regenerative approaches? I think that's, you know, that'd be amazing. That's kind of a dream, especially if part of it is, here's the science behind it all. I think all too often fellowships are, here's how you get a procedure done. And, you know, there isn't the science, especially the procedure-driven fellowships, right? I don't think that's necessarily true in TBI as an example of a fellowship where it's not procedural-driven. Maybe you'll learn a little Botox, but it's really a lot more about neuropharmacology and other things that might come in. And so I think that that could happen someday and be a positive. I think that's a little ways away, but I'd love to see that and then have that attached to it. I think at some point before then, maybe there'll be certificates and other ways that we could recognize people who have extra training.
What advice would you give for trainees who are interested in getting more involved in regenerative medicine, but maybe don't have access or can't identify mentors at their home programs? What would you recommend to those individuals?
If they're interested in regenerative medicine and the science behind it, all of that, I mean, one thing would be obvious, like, let me plug the conference, come to the conference, learn what you learn, see what you see, and decide where you want to dive in further. I think that would be one way to do it. Look, the name of our center is AR3T, Alliance for Regenerative Rehabilitation Research and Training. And if you search under AR3T in Pitt, it'll come up. And there are lunch and learns. There are hundreds of lectures. There's a ton of things that you can get. And that's just from one source. And I think that would all be really interesting and a way to kind of start yourself down that path. And it also then helps with the what's my next job? Where do I do my residency? Where do I go to med school? Kind of question to say, you know, where is the real excitement happening? You know, I'll tell you right now, just so that you know, that Fabrizia is mentoring one person who's got a K award and two physiatrists who are in the RMSTP right now, even as we speak. And so there are opportunities to learn from the best and brightest in the field if you can kind of find them.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. So we want to be respectful of your time. We just
thank
have
you. My wife. I said, hey, I'm going to be down for 7:15 for dinner.
Yeah. Maybe let's, we'll just do one last question. Okay. Cause this kind of encompasses, we had a couple of group members who contributed to some of our questions, but what would be either some words of wisdom that you'd like to share with our listeners, or maybe what would you wish that your younger self knew about kind of your training and things to kind of understand going forward with your career?
That's a great question. I mean, listen, I have to tell you that the life is a journey thing. And I can't think of something I would have done differently. I love the fact that I got an engineering degree. I really love rehab. I think it's been a great field for me. I would, if I had known ahead of time that I didn't want to be a doctor, would I have gone to med school? Maybe not. And then that would have been a horrible decision. So I wouldn't want to tell the younger me that. I think that, one of the advice I got early in my career, actually from the person who hired me at the University of Pittsburgh, was that identifying little bumps in the road versus big bumps is critical. So there's a lot of things that happen that can be a setback. And, you know, ideally you have a long and productive life. So the fact that you might not be able to accomplish research in a year or two, or that your research study doesn't pan out, I would say just, you know, don't let the small bumps keep you up at night. You know, keep the long, it's all about the long view, is probably something I could have heard a little bit more and would have slept a little bit more if I had.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate that. That's perfect. I think that's a great place to end. So I guess thank you for taking some time out to sit with us and answer some of our questions. It's been amazing. And I hope that this inspires other people to get involved and dive into this stuff, because I think it's an exciting field and there's a lot of room to grow. So we really appreciate you taking the time for this.
Anytime. Happy to come back if there's more you want to hear. Yeah. I doubt that would be the case. And good luck with the podcast. Yeah. And I appreciate the fact that you're all volunteering and that's really fantastic. So thanks for what you're doing.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening to this episode. This wouldn't be possible without the support of our listeners. Please rate, review, and subscribe. If you like these podcasts, please support the AAP so that we can continue to provide great content for you. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.